Mr. Cordes, good morning to you, and we've just got, I think everybody's in and out now, so you may approach and you may proceed.
Good morning, Chief Justice, honorable members of this court. My name is Rob Clark, I represent Desiderio Hernandez, who's been convicted in Richardson County of first-degree murder, use of a weapon, and possession of a weapon. And in this case, it was a jury trial for events that happened August 4th of 2015 into the night of August 5th, 2015. I have three assignments of error related to the statement that law enforcement took from Mr. Hernandez, and one assignment of error relating to prosecutorial misconduct. I want to begin with the assignments of error relating to the statement. The statement was taken on August 6th, 2015. So we have the 4th, the night, right before midnight, we have a shooting in a drug house in the basement. Now we'll get to the events that lead up to the statement. So we have the shooting, and we have Mr. Hernandez approaching relatives and friends of himself in Falls City, Nebraska, a short distance from where the shooting occurred. These people observe him to be either high or in a adrenaline rush, saying strange things. Basically, he's telling him he shot Mr. Cabela, and he's telling him that they need to come help. The next day, we have him, his testimony that he's observing the ambulances at the residence that they tried to administer the state. Mr. Cabela and law enforcement arrived at the crime scene. The next day, we have extensive evidence from Michael Seeger and Tiffany Gates as to his methamphetamine ingestion, taking smoking it, and smoking marijuana all day long with various people. And during this time, he is called to someone he knows in Portland, Kansas, just across the border from Nebraska, versus Tiffany Gates. Tiffany Gates is going to be present when he arrives at her house. We'll back up a bit. En route, Michael Seeger, who's been smoking methamphetamine, has testified that Desi Hernandez has been rambling, saying odd things that make no sense. Okay, we get to Tiffany's house. Upon arrival, Mr. Hernandez appears high to Tiffany. He's talking to people that aren't there, having conversations. People that aren't present saying he goes into the house, law enforcement arrives, tell him he's in that house for 8 hours over the night. And during that time, we have a number of law enforcement coming. They're doing flashbangs, I think it was like every 3 minutes or so. It's lit up with floodlights, and they're playing loud music the whole time. No response. At 3 o'clock in the morning, Mr. Hernandez steps out of that trailer. And he was arrested. During the takedown, he suffers a head injury that requires a state. During the takedown, they have shot a taser into him that gets stuck in his chest and doesn't come out. He needs to go to a hospital to attend at the hospital. It's a staple in the back of his head. At the hospital, they take a silver nitrate stick and they burn that thing closed on his chest with a taser. No evidence to it, no questions. Law enforcement. As to the medication received at the hospital during that time. And we get to... Okay,
there was no evidence there was any medication administered at all during the hospital visit.
We don't know. We don't know.
But it was a pretty short visit, as I recall, right?
It was a short time, the short time after...
He was arrested, they took him to the hospital, they medically cleared him, what, about half an hour later or something?
Yeah. The testimony was that he was medically cleared a half hour after the treatment. It isn't that he was only there for a half hour. So I don't know how long he was there, and I don't know what medications he was administered. There's no evidence of that. But the next morning, and there's testimony from Desi during statements during Desi during the statement, he's gotten no sleep. So we get to the next day at the jail, where we have two interrogators, law enforcement and Nebraska State Patrol, coming in and talking with Desi. Now, the easiest explanation for this two-hour psycho trip that you go through when you watch this video is that Desi Hernandez is intoxicated and high on methamphetamine.
What's the evidence on the record the last time that he took any methamphetamine or any other medications?
Well, we don't know the exact. We know that he's in custody at 3 a.m.
And he was doing meth the day before with the individual he was riding around with.
We don't know what was present inside the house.
When he gets to Horton, Kansas, does he have any methamphetamine with him at that point?
There was drugs seized at the truck.
Didn't Seeger testify they'd used up all the methamphetamine before they got there?
I think he testified to a couple of different versions of what happened. But even if there is no testimony that after midnight he has ingested drugs, he took me to his house. We know that once he's in the police custody, he hasn't tested or hasn't ingested drugs. So we get to the interview, and the interview is evidence that he's still high. And that's important. Cops don't ask him when the last time he was using. They don't get into that. But they try to talk, and he's incapable of an incoherent thought. We have
when they started the interrogation, they identified themselves as being from Nebraska, right? And didn't the defendant say something like, how come I'm in Kansas and you guys from Nebraska can come down and question me? Didn't he say that right at the outset?
Your Honor, there are moments of lucidity throughout that interview.
And that was at the beginning, wasn't it?
But also at that beginning, he's incapable of saying his name. He refuses to answer a direct question. For perhaps every question that he answers directly, he is answering off-topic maybe 12, 15 times. And so you talk about that period of time, and that's about when they're going through the waiver of the Miranda. Instead of answering questions, he's going into diatribes about whether or not his real name is Desi Hernandez, whether he could have been somebody else, whether his mom is the same mother as Joey DeBell, whether he's a product of incest, on and on and on.
So what is our standard of review here?
Okay. We get to the standard of review, which is historical facts, clear error, and then everything else you get to do next question. Okay? And so when it's a question about whether or not he is high on drugs, I believe you can look at that for yourself and decide whether or not the due process clauses of both the U.S. state constitutions have been violated because he is under the influence of methamphetamine. I think you can do that independent of that. And I think when you do that and you watch that video, you can see that the statements, the odd statements, the instead of pooping, I'm giving birth to children every day. I have two stomachs, just like a cow or a cow, or humans have two stomachs, and I can prove that. Or I was president when John Kennedy was shot. I was there when Michael Ryan, I was at Michael Ryan's Barnstead. Those kind of statements. We get to...
Well, let me just ask you about the John Kennedy comments. Didn't he say... Right before that, he'd made some comments about, I shot Joey. They finally got an admission in the second half of the interview, right? And then I think the investigator asked him, he said, well, you shot Joey. And he said, who told you I shot Joey? You just told me that you shot Joey. Of course I did. But I also told many people that Bill Clinton was my daddy, or I shot John F. Kennedy too. Can you guys believe that? Would you believe that? No. And then a minute or two later, he says, so you're convinced I shot Joey. Who told you? And the officer said, well, you just did. Well, I also told you I shot John F. Kennedy. Can you prove that? Didn't that happen? And I think Judge Bryan characterized that as maybe playing cat and mouse.
Judge Bryan characterized the whole interrogation with three different comments. One of them was cat and mouse, but that's part of his...
Well, how would you describe that give and take between the investigator and Hernandez when he tied it up by saying, can you prove I shot John Kennedy?
Well, honestly, Judge, after 2 hours of the interview, he appears to be sobering up or something. He does become a little bit more lucid. He's able to do basic math.
Would you agree with me? The first half, I would agree with you, is a little bizarre.
It is.
And the second half, where there were admissions, it was a different tone that the defendant had. Did that appear to you?
I would agree that there appears to be a different person at the interview. And the one that's doing the first. Of course, the one at the first is the one that needs to have the intelligent waiver of the right to not discriminate.
Well, now, speaking of waiver, that doesn't have to be in writing, right?
And I didn't say that. What I'm saying is at the time he's asked, waive his right. He's not answering the question. He's not signing the He's not answering any direct question whatsoever related to the crime. And so eventually the cops start to interject things. They start to tell him, oh, you did this because you were being abused. So that fact is
interesting. Counsel, before being taken into custody, how many times did he tell someone he shot the victim?
Your Honor, there's, and I'm so critical, because the issue is not whether or not he shot Mr. DeBella. The question in this case, because it's charged as first-degree murder, is how and why. And in order to get that how and why and sustain their conviction, they need to establish premeditation and the elements of first-degree murder. And they can only do that through his statement, because the physical evidence doesn't support that.
Well, what did he tell people why he shot him?
So he tells them, I shot him.
Why did he tell
After him? The cops tell him that you were used, that's why you did it. You were offended by what he did. He adopts that and says, I was used.
He didn't tell anybody else that he was feel like the victim was taking advantage of him financially, that he was doing the work and not getting paid for it? Was there those kind of statements?
Like what you have, what you're citing to is a reference to Mr. McPherson testifying as to whether or not Desi and the victim got along, what were the nature of the agreement. And so there was testimony that they had some disagreements about the drug trade. Okay? That's not saying that's why Desi shot him. The evidence as to why Desi shot him comes solely from the state. And so that's why the law enforcement needed the state. And I think that's part of the problem was the mental gymnastics that has to go on in order to get that statement. Let's go through those explanations.
Well, let me get back to the waiver one more time, because I agree with you. That's important. He didn't sign the form, right?
Well,
and he gave some kind of ambiguous answers on, I guess I'll sign it or something like that, right?
And that's the most important, is he's not giving answers about whether or not he wants to engage in a conversation about what happened. And so when you look at the cases, they don't care about whether or not he signed the forms, but we do want to know whether or not you are voluntarily waiving those. And we look at the conduct after the questioning begins to see whether or not you're doing it.
I totally agree. So you have to make sure they understand what the rights are, right?
Right.
And then do they waive them somehow, either expressly, or isn't there implied conduct that can do that too?
All those are factors, but you, as Your Honor has pointed out, you know, for over an hour, none of that is happening. It's just nonsense. And so we have the court trying to explain that nonsense.
And I agree with you, and you're right. The first hour was a little different. But when they tried to bring him back on task and say, how come you shot Joey to that effect, didn't he say something, and he hadn't made any admissions up to that part, he said something, well, as far as things go, anything I say can incriminate me and put me in prison. I think that's an exact quote. Didn't he say that?
Your Honor, they've been trying to keep him on task from the beginning.
But didn't he?
But he did say things that were lucid.
Well,
towards the end of the
isn't that exactly what he said? As far as things go, anything I say can incriminate me and put me in prison. Didn't he say that?
He said that. He said other things as well that were supporting of somebody that was understanding of the circumstances. But look at where that happens in that interview.
Had he made any admissions prior to that?
There were some admissions, but there were often admissions like, I shot Joey, I didn't shoot Joey. You know, immediately right after, because he's incapable of coherent thought. Now, the court tried to explain it, first of all, that Desi's just trying to explain the unexplainable. And so when you have something unexplainable, it's difficult to sound coherent and understand what you're going in. Imagine a psychologist dealing with somebody who's in a delusional state and going, well, he just has a tough situation to explain. That's why he can't explain it. That's a circular reason that I think you can ignore. The other two are just the same minimizations that the law enforcement law enforcement was worse. But the judge said he's having emotional difficulty trying to admit his actions involving his cousin Joey. And I'm not sure where Judge Bryan got that. Perhaps from those last 5 minutes or so of the interrogation where he is a little bit more lucid than the beginning. But the first part isn't that he's having difficulty dealing with Joey. It was somebody he loved, of course, and he says so. And he wishes him the best, and he's sorry for his circumstance. Remember, Joey's not dead yet. But you can't get any of that from the interview because it's just incoherent thoughts.
Well, they were bizarre comments, but they were full statements. It's not like he cut off statements. He talked about, and I think one of the investigators said, well, those are interesting thoughts, and then tried to bring him back on, but talking about people having two stomachs and all of those things.
So he could say people have two stomachs and I poop children in a full sentence. But that doesn't mean he's not intoxicated. It sounds like he is. Sergeant Townsend wants you to look at these conditions. Scatterbrain thoughts. Pooping children and cows with two stomachs is a scatterbrain thought. And there's nothing but scatterbrain thoughts throughout that. Now, Sergeant Townsend said he sees zero signs, no signs, of intoxication at all throughout the interview. And this is nothing but 90%.
And he'd been in custody at least, what, 11 hours or so before the interrogation started?
Yes.
And the last known use of methamphetamine would have been about 6 or 7 o'clock the day before, the last evidence of any meth use.
He was doing a lot.
The day before, right.
The day before and the night before.
And I think, didn't the investigator say that that he thought Hernandez was sleeping right before the interview? Did the investigator mention that in there somewhere?
Well, at the end of the interview, after they're walking away, he's telling the officers, I haven't eaten. The officers don't even care about whether or not he's had any medication. They never ask him about his sleep. They never ask him about his sleep. And they don't ask him if he's feeling okay to answer questions. They talk about delusions and lack of cohesion. There's that throughout the interview. So the signs that Sergeant Townsend would normally look for, see if somebody is intoxicated, all over the place.
Do we have case law about intoxication or influence of drugs?
We need more, Your Honor. There's not a lot from this state other than we're going to leave it up to a case-by-case analysis to decide whether or not the due process clause has been violated because the person's involuntary. And perhaps that makes sense. Because you want to be able to look at every person and whether or not this person has a tolerance for drugs different than another person. But you can look at this interrogation. You can see that he is intoxicated. And this is the explanation that most explains every one of his statements as opposed to just, it makes sense to say he's intoxicated. I have 3 minutes. I would love to talk about the last case, but I would also love to talk about the prosecutorial misconduct. I have two sets of issues in that regard. The first are a number of comments where instead of saying, I personally believe, the prosecutor's going to wrap it all up and say, it's a belief of the state of Nebraska that this person is guilty of first degree murder. Okay? And so instead of saying, I, Corey O'Brien, he says, the state of Nebraska. And my position in the brief is that just makes it 1,000 times worse. If you look at the Gonzalez case, there's not a lot of authority in Nebraska. It's not, prosecutors don't need to use this one as much as in this case. But it talks about you don't want to do that with the making yourself wrapped in the state, because it adds, like, you're more important than everybody else. Certainly more important than the defense attorney. There's a case out of Texas, an older case, that talks about statements exalting the role of the prosecutor over the defendant. It's a state versus Dykesby State, 325 Southwest 2nd, 135.
Is that cited in your brief?
It is not.
Can you give us the cite again?
I cited Gonzalez case. I don't know if Gonzalez cited to it. But it seems that Gonzalez is pretty much clear that you should make it clear. You shouldn't argue that by being representative of the state, you have more power to say. And in this case,
Mr. Cordes, you were lead counsel on this, right?
No.
Oh, you weren't. Okay, whoever it was, do you know why there was a very articulate argument made after the closing on the mistrial? But I was just curious.
Well, thank you. I made that statement.
You did, and I saw that, and it was very articulate. But I was curious why during the hour-long closing at some time there was an objection or sidebar with the judge and say, Judge, they're going too far on this. Why was there a decision made to wait?
Well, some of that isn't in the record, so I don't feel comfortable talking about the decision.
I didn't see any objections during
the... And who can't object during the time. And there were moments that Judge Brian just wanted me to make statement or objection or...
When I saw the closing, I'm sorry, when I saw the closing, I didn't see were there any efforts to make an objection during the closing.
There were not. And but the case law in Nebraska is that you don't need to interrupt. It's seen that as rude to do so. And it's okay to wait. Now, there's sometimes, you know, an attorney wants to do that just for the dramatics of it, kind of drama of it, of making that objection and stopping it right away. But for preservation, issue preservation, it is not essential that you do that right away, unlike some other issues that pop up.
You asked for a mistrial, but you didn't ask for a curative instruction. Is that accurate?
I don't think there's a curative instruction, Your Honor. It is accurate that we didn't get it. But it's also accurate that there is a general curative instruction that is given normally with the Nebraska jury instructions. It talks about the arguments of counsel are just arguments. So is that a curative instruction? I would hope we would not get to the point that that excuses every act of prosecutorial misconduct. The fact that that general instruction is given. But that instruction was. As far as the curative instruction otherwise, I don't think you could go back and tell the jury disregard personal opinions of the prosecutor. Or in this case, disregard the fact that he called the defendant disgusting scum, vermin, rat. And people that live with him are the same. And disregard the fact that the mother had to choose between life support and whether or not she should live in a persistent vegetative state for time on end. So I don't think anything could have taken place. Should an objection have been made timely? Probably. But it isn't necessary to preserve it. And it doesn't excuse the prosecutorial misconduct that occurred in this case, which is over the top. I was way out of time on it.
Thank you very much. Ms. Tangerman, good morning to you.
May it please the Court, I'm Erin Tangerman, Assistant Attorney General representing the State of Nebraska. I will start with the first assignment of error, whether Hernandez's statement was involuntary because he was under the influence of methamphetamine. The fact that he likely had drugs in his system at the time of the interview does not automatically make his statement involuntary. A defendant must be so intoxicated that he is unable to understand the meaning of his words. This is not the case with Hernandez. The interview with law enforcement began just after 2:30 p.m. on August 6th, and Hernandez had been in custody since 2:04 a.m. that day, thus just under 12 hours. There was also no evidence that Hernandez used any controlled substances during his seven-hour standoff with law enforcement, and therefore it had been close to 24 hours since he had smoked methamphetamine. In addition, the investigators testified to their training and experience regarding methamphetamine use and that Hernandez did not appear to be under the influence of methamphetamine at the time of the interview. This is supported by a review of the videotaped interview itself. When Hernandez was asked specific questions, he answered them. He was able to finish his thoughts. He demonstrated from the very beginning of the interview that he knew where he was and what he was doing. He was also the one who ended the interview after approximately 2 hours, which shows that he understood what was happening and what he was saying. Based on the totality of the circumstances, the district court was correct in finding Hernandez's statement to be voluntary.
Now, there had to be an express waiver, correct, of his Miranda rights? Express or implied, I should say.
Yes, there has to be a waiver.
And it looks like you're standing on the express portion of it. When they read the rights to him, he said, will you talk to me? And he says, I can try. And secondly, are you willing to sign here? I guess. Those would be waivers.
I think there was also, if you look back at the district court order, I believe there was also a part of, do you understand these? And he said, yeah, and continued on with it, focusing on the shooting. He was reading the paper at the time. And I believe the district court made a factual finding that he did give an affirmative waiver of his rights when he said, yeah. At that time. I think beyond that, you can look at the totality of the circumstances. He did receive the appropriate Miranda warnings. He had ample opportunity to invoke his rights before getting any answers.
Would you agree the whole half an hour, first half an hour, when they're trying to get the rights advisory and see if he understands them, there were some pretty bizarre comments going on. Would you agree?
Yes, it was bizarre.
And he never, okay, and he didn't sign the form?
He did not sign.
Which is not required, but...
Right. He did not sign the form at the time that his rights were given. His name is signed on the form in the upper portion, but that was later on.
With a lot of doodling, as
yes,
I recall.
Yes, so his name is on there, but yes, he did not sign at the time. He was asked if he needed any of his rights explained to him again, or if they explained to him, or if they needed to be repeated. The district court found he's of average intelligence, well-versed in English, and he did have the ability to communicate with the officers. He also had prior contact with law enforcement and had been interviewed 2 years prior, and had waived his Miranda rights at that time. The state put on evidence of that at the suppression hearing. So he was familiar with his rights prior to this interview. And once again, as I stated before, he did invoke his right to cut off questioning 2 hours after the interview began, which showed that he knew his rights.
Speaking of cutting off, halfway through, I think he said something. I think I'll probably stop talking now, or I ought to probably stop talking now, one of the two. But I think that probably stop talking, that seemed to be pretty clear,
yes.
Right? And I think Judge Bryan found that it said, I ought to probably stop talking now.
Yes.
But the officers didn't stop with the interrogation, did they?
Correct.
You have a problem with any of that?
No. This case is almost identical to the statements made in State v. Hilding, which was presented to this court in 2009. In that case, the defendant argued that the interview should have stopped when he said, I probably shouldn't be answering these questions, and I probably shouldn't be talking about this. The interview did not stop, and this court found it was not error. The statements were not unambiguous and unequivocal. And the same is true here. The officer was guessing what Hernandez was made by the statement, I ought to probably stop talking now. He had gone on a colloquy about various different people, and he was saying, I should stop talking about them. He could have been considering whether or not he wanted to invoke his right to remain silent, but the officer does not have to guess in the case law. I'll move to the closing arguments portion of this case, unless this court has any questions regarding the third time of error and the 403 evidence. On the closing arguments, essentially many times this issue is presented for the very first time to this court, either as plain error or under an ineffective assistance of counsel claim. But that is not the situation here. Hernandez did move for a mistrial based on the prosecutor's statements, and the district court found that if there was any error, it was harmless. The district court is in the best position to determine if a prosecutor's statement had any prejudicial impact on the jury. And because of this, Hernandez cannot establish that the district court abused its discretion in overruling its motion for a mistrial. The state submits that viewing the trial as a whole, any improper comments by the prosecutor did not prejudice Hernandez. The prosecutor's initial closing argument takes up 30 pages of the Bill of Exceptions and lasted just under an hour. Hernandez only complained about 8 isolated statements made during that lengthy closing argument. The jury was instructed not to let severe prejudice influence his verdict, and the attorney's statements were not evidence. In addition, the evidence against Hernandez was overwhelming. He confessed not only to law enforcement, but to 4 other people.
In your brief, you indicated something like some of the comments made by the prosecutor came close to crossing the line. Out of curiosity, which ones do you think came close?
I think the 8th statement that is written in the brief regarding
the heart-wrenching decision to take, made by his mother to take him off the machine.
Yes, and then I would also...
I think that came close.
Well, I think there was a reason that the prosecutor was discussing that. There was an issue raised in the case. The defense counsel was arguing that the causation ended once the mother decided to take him off the life support. That Hernandez did not commit the murder, that the causation ended when the life support was taken off, and that is the reason he died, not the gunshot to his head. So there was a reason the prosecutor was bringing that up. If he crossed the line, it was using the word heart-wrenching, but I think he was essentially saying what everybody knew, the mother just testified there at trial. And so that is a statement that I think maybe was close to crossing the line.
How about the one, ladies and gentlemen, to be perfectly honest with you, there aren't enough words in the thesaurus to describe the selflessness, senseless, heartless, disgusting acts committed not by Mr. Hernandez, the defendant, but also the other folks involved in that kind of
case. Yes, that is the second statement I would also
point to. So,
harmless error. What should the court say about these comments?
I think this court has, you know, addressed this issue a lot recently, and I think
isn't Mr. O'Brien trying this issue to have a criminal division?
Yes, he is.
Very experienced.
Yes.
And we have this issue.
Yes.
So, I'm sorry.
I've remembered that there's a human element to closing arguments, that prosecutors aren't human, that they have different personalities. I think a lot of the language that was used in this case was maybe somewhat unnecessary or over the top. But when you look at the closing argument as a whole, there are just a few little pieces of it. It was, he had a point that he was intending to prove, and then he made, like I said, over-the-top language, but he was not intending to in any way mislead or prejudice the jury in the same teaming.
I think I would like to hear an answer to the Chief Justice's question on.
I guess I don't know. I don't really have the best answer for that, but I do think, as this court has emphasized, the rough and tumble atmosphere that counsel have to be allowed to give a spirited summation. I also do
think we should put our imprimatur on these statements.
I don't know. I do agree what Judge Hampson talked about, that if an objection had been made right away when the statement was made, the court had an opportunity at that point to instruct the jury that it could have been over at that point.
But they didn't have to, right?
They didn't have to, and I do agree that the case law, everything he did was proper here, that there's nothing under the case law that wages there.
Should the trial judge have intervened on his own?
I don't think, not in this case, I don't think so. I think the trial judge himself, in overruling the motion for mistrial, didn't even agree that all the statements that were made were misconduct.
How would you respond to the suggestion that prosecutors aren't going to take this seriously unless we reverse?
I don't think that's true. I do think prosecutors take opinions of this more serious. I think that once again, it gets into the heat of the moment. Things are said, emotions are high. I do not believe there was any intention to influence the jury in any negative way, in any prejudice to the defendant.
Should we refer this to counsel for this one?
No, I don't think this was the intention. I think there was a point, in using those words, there was a point that the prosecutor was attempting to make to recognize that the general facts of this case were terrible. This man was leaning on the floor, gasping for air, and these people, these witnesses, state's witnesses, were walking around him trying to gather the drugs. He was recognizing that he understands that the victim was not often, was not a sympathetic victim, that the witnesses did not seem very credible, and he was attempting to acknowledge to the jury that this is a terrible case, that these may not be the most trustworthy people, but however, they are not the people that did this, they are not the suspects. And I think that was the point that he was trying to get across. Was over the top, potentially some of the words he used, yes, but I think when you look at the closing argument as a whole, there was no intentional misconduct here.
I think Mr. Corris, in his motion for mistrial, said prosecutorial ethical standards are those applicable, the ones that decided, I think,
I don't recall if they were regarding the personal beliefs or which ones he cited.
But are those prosecutorial ethical standards, do they apply in this case?
The state disagrees with the statements of the state beliefs or the evidence, this and that. I don't think that's stating a personal belief. I think there's no difference than saying the state's position is this, so we would not agree with that.
The ones that you thought came close to the line, those are the ones I'm talking about, which I may disagree with you, but maybe they at least come close.
I guess I don't know. I don't feel comfortable answering that at this point. I think it goes back to the district court found this was fair. He did not find that a prejudice to the jury, and I think this court cannot find an abuse of discretion. The evidence against her
much you know of law enforcement. I think that...
Well, isn't that your answer to the chief's question about how to prevent this?
Yes, yes. There was no prejudice, yes. Unless this court has any additional questions, we ask you to affirm the judgment of the decision.
Thank you very much. Do we have any time for rebuttal? Go on to the next case of the day, which is State v. Ivan K.